Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to welcome back here to the show Dave Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk a little bit about personal finance. And the way that this works is that he begins making a few comments. And I think that he's going to talk here to start out about what's been going on lately in the mortgage market. And if you then have questions about that or anything else that has to do with basic kind of investing strategies or financial planning, whatever it is, you want to call in and talk about your specific situation, he will do his best to help you out. So with that, we say, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, it's always a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, I'd like to start talking a little bit about our old favorite couch potato portfolio. It was only a month ago that our portfolio was steaming down the tracks with a gain of over 10% for the year. And suddenly, once again, just 4 weeks later, everyone is very concerned about the credit markets and particularly the subprime mortgage crisis. We'll talk a little bit about that in just a moment. And in fact, in the past 4.5 weeks, major U.S. market indices have dropped some 7 to 8% from their highs. And as a result, our couch potato portfolio consisting of 8 U.S. and international stock indexes through yesterday's close, inclusive of dividends, is ahead just a little bit under 5% for the year. And that's compared to about 3.9% for the S&P 500. So while we're moving just a little bit ahead of the S&P at the moment, well, we've lost a lot of ground in the last 4.5 weeks. There's a lot of concerned stock market investors, certainly over the last month. Now, obviously, markets continue to be in a turmoil over really the subprime market crisis. Just a few months ago, we began a discussion on this very program on subprime mortgages, which essentially are mortgages made to borrowers who shouldn't have gotten them in the first place. That's really the bottom line. Borrowers of questionable credit quality or borrowers who received a very high interest rate and received that loan without documentation, called a no-doc loan. These loans are clearly non-investment grade and involve substantial risk to the end holders of these particular loans. Now, one of the best articles I have read on the subprime mortgage crisis actually appeared yesterday in the edition of the Asia Times. It was authored by Jonathan Lee, who is a certified financial analyst, a money manager, and really a gold expert. And a substantial portion of my following remarks are either directly quoted from Mr. Lee or based on Mr. Lee's article, as well as several recent articles in the Wall Street Journal. First, how do we measure subprime losses? How do we measure the size of the subprime market? Let's start with the notion of the total value of all residential real estate in the United States. Although it's been sliding, most experts put it somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 trillion plus. That's just residential real estate in the United States. That's not corporate real estate. That's not shopping centers. That's not hotels, motels, golf courses. We're talking residential real estate, somewhere in the area of about $20 trillion. Now, of that $20 trillion, how much is indebted by mortgages? At any one time in the United States, it's usually about half. So whatever that number is, we multiply it times 50%. And a good estimate is that today the current U.S. mortgage market is about a $10 trillion number. Now, that's a very big number. That's substantial because that's larger than the entire U.S. Treasury market. That's larger than our total national debt, which is in excess of $9 trillion. So I'm trying to give you some size here of what we're talking about. And of that $10 trillion mortgage market, the government, and when I talk about the government, I'm really talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are really conventional loans, they hold on their shelves at any one point in time about 15% of that mortgage market, call it $1.5 trillion. That leaves somewhere in the neighborhood of 85% or $8.5 trillion of other mortgages. Some of them are very high quality, AAA. Some of them are very low quality. In fact, in my investments class, I invented triple G. I call that the new rating. Most people think about A, B, and C. I call it triple G. That's called garbage, garbage, garbage. All right? And some of that mortgage market is indeed triple G. Well, how much of it is probably this subprime mortgages where we've made these loans to people who really shouldn't have gotten them perhaps in the first place? I've done a lot of research. I've looked at Fed numbers. I've looked at government numbers. I've looked at various consulting company numbers. And it looks to me that the best number that I can come up with is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2.5 trillion of these subprime mortgages. So I'm going to just suggest a radix, a census, if you will, of about $2 trillion. Well, how much is $2 trillion? Well, it's a bunch. And when we think about how much of that $2 trillion is currently in default, most people and most statistics put that estimate currently of actually defaults of about 15%. So if we take 15% of $2 trillion currently, that's about $300 billion of assets, money that's smoke. All right? That's up just in smoke. Someone, somewhere is probably going to lose in the neighborhood of $300 billion of money in principal and interest that just simply is in default. It's unlikely to be collected. That's a big number, but keep in mind, of course, that we essentially distribute more than $500 billion annually in Social Security benefits. If we add in Medicare and Medicaid to that number, it's over $1 trillion. If we look at our GDP of $13 trillion and we're looking at $300 billion, well, it doesn't seem so big. The real concern is how these particular defaults are affecting the value of existing subprime portfolios in total. So if we've got 15% in default, what's that doing to the value of this other 85%? In other words, what's that doing to this value of another $1.5 to $1.75 trillion that's out there in subprime mortgages? And the news isn't very good, because to the extent that you can even find bids and asks on this paper where it's trading hands, it seems to be trading hands somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30% on the dollar. So now if we take this $2 trillion number, multiply it times 25%, or essentially have a 75% loss, now we're talking some serious money. We're actually talking right down somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 trillion potential write-downs on subprime mortgages. And I remember Everett Dirksen, when he was senator of the state of Illinois. David, I can't remember, was it a million here and a million there? Or
I think
it was a billion in those days.
Okay,
it was a billion. I just simply couldn't remember. He'd say, you know, a billion here, a billion there, you're talking some real money.
Yeah.
Well, a trillion here, a trillion there, you're talking some real money. All right? So this is beyond a $200 billion crisis. And the truth of the matter is that holders, who are usually banks, financial institutions, other publicly traded entities, are supposed to mark their assets to the market, and they're reluctant to take these gigantic write-downs. You're hearing about write-downs of $5 billion, $4 billion, $8 billion, but no one in their wildest dreams is contemplating that these subprime mortgages perhaps could be trading at 25, 30, 40 cents on the dollar, and we're suddenly going to be writing down hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of dollars. Also, here's another major problem. We have a spillover effect from the subprime mortgage area to really conventional financing and AAA mortgages. They now have begun to trade lower, sort of in sympathy with these subprime mortgages. And in fact, recent trades are 70 to 80 cents on the dollar. So now, if we were marking all of these other mortgages to the market, this other $6, $7, $8 trillion, and we were discounting that 20%, That's another $1.5 trillion. These are stunning numbers. So what we're really looking at and what the doomsdayers are looking at, I'm not suggesting this is going to happen, but the doomsday mentality, and always it's the old story, everything always goes from one end to the other end. You know, it's somewhere in the middle is the true story, but people just overcook it or undercook it. And what we're looking at is possibly, in the worst possible light, write-downs in the trillions of dollars, not the billions of dollars. And this is what has clearly spooked Wall Street. Now, you might ask, who in the world holds these trillions of dollars of mortgages? And here I'm going to quote Jonathan Lieb because I think he says it best. Quote, thanks to the genius of the American banking and marketing machine, just about every sizable institution underneath the sun with a fixed income portfolio holds these mortgages. From Europeans to Asians, from banks to brokerage, from hedge funds to pension funds, institutions to retail, trusts to even endowments. And most of these institutions are in a state of shock. They have been reluctant to mark down their $1 trillion-plus subprime portfolio to market. Every other day, as Mr. Lee points out, there is a new revelation of substantial subprime loss. First, it was New Century in March, then American Mortgage and Countrywide in September. Then it got worse. It was Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Credit Suisse, First Boston, Citibank, Merrill Lynch, all of these. And just, what, a couple of days ago, E-Trade dropped 59%. Everybody's darling, the discount broker, it dropped 59% in value in one day. Why? Because E-Trade has a bank. And what was that bank holding on its balance sheet? Why, some of these interesting pieces of paper, some of these subprime mortgages, really in the form of something called collateralized debt obligations. So what's happening out there? Credit is a whole lot tougher. It's a whole lot tougher for corporations, and it's a whole lot tougher for the consumer. Short-term borrowing is tougher for everyone, especially major corporations. Long-term borrowing is a lot tougher for consumers. And the American consumer is being squeezed. Look at these record high oil prices in the 90s the last few weeks. We know what gas is at the gas pump. It's like a tax increase when you're paying $3 plus for gas. We're seeing it in the cost of our foodstuffs, much more expensive at the grocery store. That's certainly no secret. We've got declining home values, partially because some of these mortgages are defaulting. The homes backing those mortgages are going into foreclosure. There's been a prolific building oversupply, and there are tougher standards to qualify for residential mortgages. We just heard on NPR this morning, the Senate and the House is saying, oh, we've got to come down on these subprime borrowers, whatever that means. We've got higher consumer debt. We've got a whole lot of things that are coalescing at the same time. And all of that, of course, in the short run, not necessarily in the long run, because things in the long run generally improve, but we've got a lot of short run issues. All of that spells bad news for corporations because corporate profits are decreasing. When corporate profits decrease, corporate earnings go down. And in the final analysis, when we look at the value of stocks, it is tied to that stream of future earnings that a company is going to earn. And we somehow discount that back to some present value to get an idea of what that stock is really worth. So when people are saying, gee, it's going to be tough to have good earnings in the future, we're going to depress the value of stocks. And that is why we are seeing so much volatility over the last 3, 4, 5 weeks, and really several times this year, where we're seeing broad market moves, 1, 2, 3% moves in some of these indexes in any one good day. How's it going to turn out? It'll eventually get solved. There's going to be some winners, some losers. It's going to get wrung out of the economy, but it's going to be bumpy. It's going to be bumpy in the short run. So you've got to be appropriately diversified. You just can't be out there owning one or two or three bank stocks, financial institutions, because you can be a holder of E-Trade and you can get hammered 59% in any one day. So there you have it, David, just a brief review of what this mortgage crisis is really about. Why is it spilling over? Why does it involve the stock market? How does that create volatility? So I guess we're going to have to stay tuned. I'd be happy to answer questions on anything I've raised or obviously other questions from our listening audience.
All right. We already have some people who are ready to go here. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And on this show, once a month, always on a Friday, he's here, and we talk about financial issues, economic, money management, investment. If you have specific question about your own situation, you can give us a call. We have several people who are ready to go, and we'll start in with a caller in St. Joe. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question regarding asset allocation for seniors.
Yes.
As I recall, you recently recommended one subtract your age from 110, and then the difference is the percent one should have in equities. And I just wonder, are there any exceptions to your recommendation?
Well, that's an old rule. I don't think I've gone over that in a long time. It's just sort of a starting place.
Okay.
It's sort of a starting place. And I, in terms of a senior today, I'm pretty comfortable with an asset allocation of 40 to 50% in equities.
Okay.
Now, what I'm extraordinarily concerned about, and I'm glad you brought this up, I'm very concerned about the fixed income side of the balance sheet, even more concerned about that than really the equity side of the balance sheet. I'm pretty comfortable at a couch potato portfolio or a series of indexes as long as you're properly diversified. But where is that 40 or 50% sitting? A lot of folks have those assets in long-term sort of what I would call market mutual funds, income mutual funds, but we've got to start looking at the underlying assets in those particular fixed income mutual funds. I, for one, am much more comfortable at the moment, first of all, being very short term if I own money market mutual funds or a similar investment. And number two, I want very, very high credit quality. So I want quality like T-bills, T-notes, T-bonds. Right now, I think one should be looking at those kinds of investments and looking with a jaundiced eye at whether or not my fixed income mutual fund is holding long-term bonds, collateralized mortgage obligations, other kinds of debt instruments.
Right.
So I'm suggesting that people look very carefully and make certain that they have very, very high quality on their fixed income side. Now, if you're at local financial institutions with certificates of deposit, et cetera, that are FDIC insured, I feel very, very comfortable with those kinds of assets as well.
Excellent. Now, in our case, we're both in our 70s, but we're able to save significant amounts from our income. And right now we have a 60-40 allocation, 60% equities. And I'm just wondering if we need to reconsider that and possibly go to maybe 50-50 or lower that equities, even though we're able to save.
I think that in your particular case, 50-50 makes a lot more sense than 60-40.
Okay.
You don't need to take risk, and you're really continuing to accumulate funds. So I think a 50-50 allocation, I'm very comfortable with that given what you have told me.
Okay.
And then that 50% on the fixed income side, I want very high quality.
Right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Right, thank you. Next is Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Start a little conversation with a personal note with Mr. Sinnoh. How is the fishing?
Well, that's very interesting. We met, about 2.5 weeks ago?
Something like that.
And had a wonderful conversation on the banks of the Vermilion River system that particular day. And as it turned out, my partner and I went muskie fishing that day, and I was fortunate enough to catch a muskie about 39 inches.
Oh.
It probably was I'm guessing between 14 and 17 pounds.
Oh, my.
So we were waiting. And very fortunately, we didn't have to take the fish out of the water. By the time it came in, it was in about a foot of water, just was able to unhook it. It was a little bit tired, but it swam away, and it was a very happy fish going back into the Vermilion River system. So we appreciated your tips, and thank you so much.
How was your significant other's canoe ride?
Well, that was great, too. She did about 2.5 miles, or two and a half hours.
Oh, yeah,
not 2.5 miles, 2.5 hours. Downstream and then coming back upstream. And so she had a great, great trip.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is with this situation that Mr. Bush has got us into, isn't that really responsible for some of this situation we've got today?
Well, because you'll have to elaborate for me how Mr. Bush got us into this situation.
Well, he's borrowed so much money for this war that he's really tied up a lot of the credit.
Well, there's no question that by allocating somewhere between $150 and $200 billion annually for this war, it has exacerbated our deficit. And yes, we've had to borrow that money and issue more treasuries. So as a result, that has hurt our currency. There's no question about that. But I'm wondering if we hadn't spent it there, whether it was Mr. Bush or anyone else, if we would spend it somewhere else.
I see. Well, then, thank you very much.
All right, thank
thanks
you.
For calling in. It was a pleasure visiting with you.
We're already about at our midpoint here. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about investing, money management. Questions are welcome. We have several here ready to go, and we'll get right to them. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the next is in Urbana, and line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about how one goes about balancing investments when one index fund does really, really well, another one's doing okay, but one is getting
much better, like Total International, for example, or an emerging markets fund, which have really been the stars this year as compared to the U.S. market.
So what
do we do?
How do you do it?
How do you do it?
And also, at what point do you do it, and how often?
Well, I do it once a year. Some people do it semi-annually, but I'm sort of a once-a-year guy. So I look at that portfolio at the end of the year, and if I am basically misallocated, I have too much in one particular index, then I sell that index, and I reallocate it into the other indexes, so I'm back to my original portfolio percentage. So I like to start at the beginning of the year pretty close to the tolerances within that portfolio. Now, I want to mention tolerances. So if I'm shooting for 10% in the S&P 500 and I have 11% or 9%, I really don't get too concerned about that because I'm within a tolerance. On the other hand, if I'm supposed to have 25% of my equity portfolio in a Total International index and suddenly I'm at 30 or 35, then I want to reallocate. But generally, I do that at the end of the year. And I also, for myself as well as most people, we're going to have a combination of after-tax mutual funds as well as mutual funds that are not subject to tax if we move money, for example, inside IRAs, inside 401ks, inside Roths, 403bs. So I try to make most of the moves in my tax-deferred or tax-free investment portfolio. So I don't generate a lot of capital gains or tax impact when I do make those moves.
Say you're dollar cost averaging into these two funds, just to make life simple here. Would another way to do it be to simply stop contributing to the one that's gained a whole lot and assume that the other one is essentially on sale and continue dollar cost averaging into the lower cost one so that you eventually balance out?
Could do that, and that's something called value cost averaging. That's what you're really trying to do there. It's a term called value cost averaging. I'm a little concerned about that. I would prefer continuing to dollar cost average and then rebalancing it either every 6 months or at the end of the year.
Okay.
Okay.
One other quick question.
Yes.
Somewhere I have seen that some of the major funds, like Vanguard and I think Magellan and so forth, now have they have a foundation, a charitable foundation. So if you have, if you're somebody, for instance, who can't itemize deductions, but you want to be able to take advantage of, you want to get to be able to itemize deductions, in other words, have enough deductions. So you
right, but point. You haven't given the money to charities.
But you can't afford to give it, you know, all at once.
All at once, right.
So
how do you do that, and what is that all about?
Well, my understanding is that they have now have funds where you can plunk it in there, and then
that's true.
Well, so you can get enough 1 year, but you actually dole it out to the charities that you want.
That's correct. That's called a donor advised fund, and most of the major mutual funds now companies have something called a donor advised fund, and that would enable you, for example, to take $10,000, just as an example. Place that in the Vanguard Donor Advised Fund. Choose the actual mutual funds that you can invest in. And then you are required by law to essentially distribute a certain percentage of that money each year to charities. But when you move $10,000 of your money into the Vanguard Donor Advised Fund, you have parted with that $10,000. You have moved it into a charitable fund. It's just that the fund hasn't distributed it because it's waiting for your instructions. In any event, that $10,000 then becomes an itemized deduction on your tax return.
Okay. Thanks a bunch.
My right, pleasure.
Thank you. And again, we'll go here to another caller. And the next is, this is also someone in Urbana, and it's line three.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I haven't heard very much about is how the subprime a crisis that you talked about affects, say, tax-free municipals. And I have some excess money in Vanguard tax-free money market. And I've wondered how it affects that fund or municipals in general. And then a second question is, when you hear from some of the fund companies about what to do with regard to what's happening in the market, what they always say is stay the course. But I want to check with you, David, to see if that's what you would say, stay the course. I mean, would you make any kind of adjustments in your allocations or as a result of this subprime business?
Those are great questions. Let's talk about the tax-free money markets first, whether you're at Vanguard, whether you're at T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, etc. It always goes back to quality. And what you want to ask is what percentage of those – they're really – what you're really in are something called TANs, tax anticipation notes, that a tax-free money market account – is really comprised of issuers who issue tax anticipation notes in anticipation of issuing longer-term bonds. That's why it's called a money market, because it has a short-term duration. In any event, what you want to know is what percentage of those issuers are going to issue general obligation municipal bonds, GOs. GOs, or general obligation municipal bonds, are backed by the full faith and credit of the taxing authority of the issuer. And that taxing authority is either an issuer who can actually raise our income taxes, like the state of Illinois, or through referendum or whatever means, can raise our real estate taxes. So if the city of Champaign, the city of Urbana, wanted to build four new schools, they're going to go back in the form of a referendum and say, dear property owners, we need these four schools. We need to raise your real estate taxes, yay or nay, right? So if I've in a money market tax-free fund with these TANs, these tax anticipation notes, and the very substantial portion of them are based upon the taxing authority of the various issuers, then I'm pretty comfortable. I also want a very, very short maturity. I don't want to be out there 9 to 12 months in these tax anticipation notes. So short-term maturity and backed ultimately by general obligation instruments, then I think you're fine. Number two, as far as this business of staying the course in other kinds of fixed income funds, I'm saying no. I'm not saying stay the course. What I'm saying is look at the credit quality of that fund. And I, for one, really, in terms of all of the fixed income that I own, either for myself or on behalf of my clients, are in very, very short-term, high-quality money market funds. And it would not even be unreasonable to take your money in a standard, high-quality money market fund and move that to a money market fund which is comprised entirely of U.S. Treasury instruments. You're going to sacrifice about 80 basis points, about 8 tenths of 1% on an annualized basis, to move to the highest credit quality, which are short-term fixed income, really T-bills, or very short-term T-notes. So that would not be a bad thing to do. So this business about staying the course on the fixed income side, I'm a little leery of that advice.
Okay. Thank you, David.
My pleasure.
Right, thank you. And on again to the next caller, Germantown Hills, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I really appreciate the Focus 580 and particularly like it when Professor Senno is the guest. So keep it up, guys.
Thank you.
I have a brief question. We're in our late 60s. In another year or so, we have to start dealing with the mandated withdrawal of some of our IRAs. We have investments sort of scattered around in a number of places, some IRAs, other mutual funds, and some variable annuities and some other things. Our question is, as we start to draw down some of these investments for travel, for helping grandchildren with college, for whatever other purpose we might have, I'd like to be able to find a good book or an article or two that describe what is a smart practice in terms of tax planning and overall good management of assets. I get little bits and pieces of things from various advisors, but I've never seen a good overall description of an overall plan.
You know, that's a great question, and I have to do some thinking on it. It's such a great question. I'm going to do some research on it. Have you visited Scott Burns' website?
No, I have not.
I think you should Google in Scott Burns, who's a columnist, and Scott does a lot of great work and utilizes a lot of other articles to tell you what kinds of distributions you should be taking on an annualized basis out of your portfolio, given the fact that you might be allocated 60-40 or 50-50, whatever. So he does a real nice job on that. And he is always hammering on the issues of taxes. So I would go to some of those articles, but I need to do some research. Maybe I need to write something myself, maybe 4 or 5 pages, sort of explaining my theory on it. Here's the bottom line. When you eventually reach that magic age of 70 and a half, so if you're in your 60s, you've still got a little while to go.
Not long. We're in the late 60s.
All right. You're going to have to start taking minimum distributions out of tax-deferred investments. Are you retired?
Yes.
Okay. So if you have 403Bs and 401Ks and SEP IRAs or IRAs or whatever they are, some annuities, you're going to have to start taking a minimum distribution. But the minimum distribution is not terribly, terribly horrible in the first few years of these minimum distributions. Actually, it's quite small. Mm-hmm. In the first year, it's about 1/27th. The actual denominator is 27.4, especially if you're within 10 years of each other in age. And I presume that you and your spouse are within 10 years of each other.
We are.
Okay, so that's a fair statement. So let's just presume that among that universe of assets, it was $100,000. You would be required to take 1/27th approximately of that. Not very much. It's really actually less than 4%. So you'd be taking a minimum distribution of about $4,000. Of course, all of that gets added to your other income. So in effect, it's being taxed at its highest marginal rate.
Right.
So if you found yourself in a 25% bracket, a 28, a 31, whatever it may be, you're going to be taxed at that rate on that money. So the next year, it drops into the high 126s. So the first several years, even in a 50-50 portfolio, you may well be earning in excess of what your minimum distribution is required to take. Now, if you're at a computer, you can Google minimum distribution rules. You'll get 100 websites that'll pop up, and it will show you exactly what those distribution requirements are for the average person once they start at 70.5. Remember, you can always take more. Once you're 59.5, you can certainly access that money. The bottom line is, when you start accessing, you got to start paying tax. So that's sort of my reaction to your question. Go to the Scott Burns website. Take a look at that. He has lots of good information on some of the issues you're raising. I'll do some independent research, report back next month.
Okay.
And see if I can come up with a book or an article that really dispositively examines the issues you've raised.
Okay. Is it Burns, B-U or B-Y?
B-U-R-N-S.
Okay.
Scott, S-C-O-T-T, I believe. Is it? Maybe it's one T, but if you just Google it
in. I think it's
in,
two T's.
Is it two T's?
And
I
also
so.
his column does appear, I think, twice a week.
Couple times
the,
a week.
The news, in our
local
newspaper,
paper,
News Gazette.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We
got
about 10 minutes, maybe 15 left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. And once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Sydney, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I have a mutual fund for our teenage daughter that was done under the Uniform Transfer to Minors Act.
Yes.
And it was about 15 years ago before the 529 college savings plans became available. Most of the money we want to use, at least some of it, for college savings. But when we apply for financial assistance for college, this money's in her name, and she'll be expected to use a substantial amount of it for college.
That's true.
So I'm wondering, is it possible to transfer this money to a 529 college savings plan that is not in her name? And what are the financial pros and cons in terms of tax planning and financial assistance for college?
Well, you've asked a mouthful. There is an animal called a custodial 529, which means that parents are taking custodial money and they are transferring it to a 529 plan. Now, keep in mind, in a 529 plan, that money, while you are the sponsor of the 529, that money is really the child's money. It's been gifted for the benefit of the child. And you probably would need to consult. Do you have a tax advisor?
Yes.
All right. You would need to consult with your tax advisor to see what the impact of that transfer would be. Let me ask you this. The particular mutual fund that you are in, I presume that you have a substantial capital gain if you've been putting money into this for 15 years?
Yes.
All right. So there is a capital gains issue. And it, with respect to this particular mutual fund, is it part of a family of mutual funds? In other words, are there a number of different mutual funds that you could access?
Well, it's in an American Shares. And
oh, American Funds?
Yes, American.
All right. Well, American Funds sponsors a 529 plan. So one of the things that you could do is you could call American Funds, ask for an advisor who specializes in 529 plans. They can then call up your account. They can discuss the notion of a custodial 529. They can look at the basis, which if you've always been at American Funds, they can look up your tax basis, your market value, and give you your options.
Okay.
So I think that would be your starting point. Now, how old is the child?
Well, she's 16.
Okay. She's 16. Then she's going to start school in a couple of years?
Yep.
All right. And then she's probably going to access that money?
Yes.
All right. Now, something else that you want to keep in mind, if you're going to use that money for undergraduate education, you don't want to be taking a lot of risk with that money. So if you are in just a good old-fashioned vanilla stock mutual fund, you might consider repositioning some of that money and becoming a little bit more conservative. Even though I'm aggressive in the long term, if I've got a time horizon of 20, 25, 30 years, we're looking at a six-year time horizon here. And, of course, over the next six consecutive years, I don't have a crystal ball. It's very possible that that money could even go down. So you don't want to have that happen. So you need to think about a couple of questions. One, what is the impact of moving that custodial account, given its current circumstances, into a custodial 529? And then once that money is there, should it be repositioned a bit more conservatively?
Very good. Thank you so much for your advice.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Next is someone here back in Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I heard you say that there's a $9 trillion debt of the government.
That's our national debt, $9
trillion. Debt. Where is that money, or how did it get that?
Well, every year, we as a government, as a federal government, spend more money than we take in. This is nothing new. So if we take in $2.5 trillion of taxes from all sources, whether it's federal income tax, Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes, airplane taxes, you name it, gasoline taxes, estate taxes, that's a number that's around $2.5 trillion. And we seem to spend a whole lot more than that each year. All right? And as a result, if we spend more than we take in, then we have to borrow the money. And the way the U.S. government borrows the money is that they issue IOUs in the form of treasury instruments. And a lot of folks buy them. Individuals buy them. Governments buy them. And indeed, some of these treasuries are actually owed to other branches of the government. So, for example, for a whole lot of years, until very, very recently, we took more money in Social Security taxes than we paid out in Social Security. But we didn't put that money aside for Social Security. Oh, no. We spent it for everything else. So what did the government do? What does the Treasury do? Why, it issues an IOU to the Social Security division of our federal government. That's how it works. So a lot of this $9 trillion is actually owed internally to other areas of our government. But the majority of it is actually in the hands of individuals, mutual funds, corporations, foreign governments, etc. That's how it happened.
How can they get away with that?
Well, how can we get away with it? I think it's the same story as how we as individuals get away with it. We as a society seem to spend more than we typically take in. I guess the Depression folks learned their lesson and said, you know, you need to spend less than you take in. But this generation and my generation and typically young people, they have a different outlook. So that's how it happens. That's where the $9 trillion comes from. Now, we have to look at that number in light of our GDP. So if we look at our gross domestic product, which is $13, $14 trillion, depending upon who you believe, it's still significantly less than our annual GDP, but still a monster number, because if we take $9 trillion and we apply a 4-4.5% interest rate to that number, after all, we've got to pay this money back, that's $300 to $400 million of interest that we've got to be paying back to someone each year, which means there's not $300 or $400 billion of funds that are available to spend for education, to spend for health care, to spend for poverty-stricken individuals in the United States. That's $300 to $400 billion that's going out the door to holders of those treasuries. Okay, so I thought I would brighten your day.
Yes, you did. I just feel all depressed.
Well, here's the answer. We've got 300 million Americans. We've got a $9 trillion debt. Everybody needs to just pull out their checkbook, write a check for $30,000 to the government, and just ipso facto, we eliminate it. We eliminate that debt.
Oh, my God.
Okay, a pleasure visiting with you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we'll put that one up to a vote and see how we end up. Champagne, next, line 1. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Hey, I have an inherited IRA, and I'm 48 years old. This year, I'll have to start taking minimum distributions, and I believe I have to take it at the rate of my mother's age and not mine.
Well, though, wait a second. Was your mother already pulling money out of that IRA?
Yes, she was.
Now, there are some special rules. There are new rules about that. So I would urge you to consult with the certified public accountant about whether or not given the circumstances of that IRA, how it was inherited, whether or not you can do life expectancy or whether you have to take it out over her life expectancy. There are some changes in those rules that have come down in the last 12 to 24 months. So everyone's circumstance is different.
I have a question concerning the whole Ball Act.
Okay.
What would be wrong with just, can I take all of it out at once and then just put it in a Roth IRA and I won't have to deal with distributions anymore, pay the tax once, and then just let it grow?
The answer is yes, you can take the money out on a one-time basis. Are you married?
Yes.
Okay. So long as your adjusted gross income as a married couple filing jointly is not in excess of $100,000.
That'll be fine.
Okay. No. If you're under $100,000, then you could take that money out of the IRA, say whatever it is, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, pay your tax on it. It doesn't count against your AGI for purposes of whether you can roll to a Roth. And then you can roll into a Roth and let it grow tax-free, and you never have to touch it.
And is that a good idea?
Is that a good idea? Well, I can't answer that without knowing a whole lot more about your financial situation. How old are you?
48.
48? What marginal tax rate would you find yourself in with that money?
24%.
Okay. Probably not a bad idea.
Okay.
It's not a bad mousetrap.
All right.
All right. If you can deal with giving up the money now and then, because you know something that's very interesting. Most people think at retirement they're going to be in a lower tax bracket. Probably not. Probably not. And when you have a $9 trillion debt, my bet would be that tax rates are going to go up, not go down.
Unfortunately true.
All right. So maybe we're on the same page here.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. My pleasure.
I'll get at least one more here. The caller is in Morton Grove on line 4. Hello.
Yes. Hi. I have a question concerning the Roth IRA and when I might access them. I have contributed since the Roths became available each year, the maximum, and I was wondering, under those circumstances, a guy like myself with bad bookkeeping here, not sure exactly because I've moved them over the years from bank to bank and where the best interest rate might be, pretty conservative and kind of lost sight of good record keeping here. If I wanted to access them sometime down the road after I exhausted my traditional IRA, how do I go about proving I've had these for 5 years or whatever is required?
Well, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is once you're 59 and a half, then you're going to be able to access those Roth IRAs.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. Don't access anything before 59 and a half. Okay. And it sounds like you're going to be utilizing your traditionals first.
Right.
And letting your Roths just ride, which might make sense given your circumstances. So I think you don't have a problem here.
Okay.
The fact that you moved it from bank to bank is irrelevant. The fact that you're just doing it on an annualized basis, that's okay. Wait till 59 and a half.
Okay. Well, that clears that up. I was really worried about that.
No, don't worry about it. The other rule that most people don't understand is if you did good bookkeeping, let me get that out, you probably could even take your principal out at any time and not even pay any tax on the principal. So that's another misunderstood rule as well. So wait till at least 59 and a half. You should be in good shape.
Thanks again.
All right. And one more caller here. This is line 2, and the caller is in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I want to thank you for your introductory remarks. I come down feeling that I just have to go along for the ride. The banks who made all these bad loans deserve to take a hit, but they're going to share it in every way possible.
You bet.
Then my other question is your opinion on as taxes go up and prices continue to go up on farmland, there's going to be an effect on how much we are subsidizing conservation programs. I mean, I have a business, and I can take that hit now, but as my taxes go up and the land value goes up, there will come a day when I say I can't continue to volunteer to not rent this particular acreage, I just can't subsidize that conservation program anymore.
There's no question about it. As a matter of fact, there have been a number of articles in the Wall Street Journal over the last several weeks talking about this very issue where people are pulling money, pulling land out of conservation programs, paying the penalty now, and then placing that land back into production for these very reasons.
Well, you know, rents are getting up. Some areas are close to $200 an acre. And when you are subsubsidizing that land, you know, it's just...
Very tough economically to continue to do it.
Well, and I'm continuing, and I will continue for a while, but there is a limit.
No question about it.
What your feelings were on
Yes, that. Yes. And as I say, if you happen to read in the Wall Street or you go online, there are a number of articles about this.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Right, thank you for the call. Well, we are just about the point that we're going to have to finish. Any last thought you want to leave people
with?
Well,
David, that was a lot of very, very interesting, technical, multivariate questions. I haven't heard questions like that in a long time, and that's one of the fun things about doing this show, besides seeing you here, David, every month. You're sort of like an old friend, and I want to wish all of our listeners, as well as the staff of WILL, a very joyous holiday season, a great Thanksgiving, and look forward to visiting in December, and we'll see what markets look like in December.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business, and once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. We appreciate his being here, and also we want to urge you that be very careful in the financial decisions you make. Do your homework. Do as much research as you can. Get a lot of opinions, and think very carefully about what you're going to do with your money before you do it. But we certainly appreciate his being here.